Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings from the Hill Country of Central Texas. This is Revolution of Military Affairs, and I'm your host, Amos Fox. All right, welcome back to Revolution of Military Affairs, a podcast about war and warfare. Today we're continuing our series with Hypergiant, and we're talking with Quentin Donnellan, who goes by Q. So throughout the conversation, I'll be referring to him as Q, just so you guys are all tracking that. And he works with Hypergiant and is a key player within the organization. So I thought it was in conversation with the leadership at Hypergiant, Q is a great person to bring in to talk about what Hypergiant does. And specifically today, we'll be talking in a bit of depth about CJAD C2. So with that, Q, before we get started, just thank you for your time. I know it's been challenging to get the time locked in, but I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Amos. You know, one of the, I guess, the consequences of success in the business side is calendars are hard to wrangle. So I appreciate the patience. Happy to be on here talking with you and your audience today.
Thank you. And I guess the first question, and this is what I've opened up with both Mike Betzer, Jay, and Mike Finlent, is what is artificial intelligence?
That's a heck of an opening question. quite loaded. You know, I the academics, there are, of course, academic answers out there that you can peruse. And there's a wide range, certainly, on the marketing definition of what justifies being able to say you are an AI company or artificial intelligence should be ascribed to the things that you provide. I'll provide a perspective from the lens of how does artificial intelligence aid the warfighter in the particular domains that Hypergiant, my company, is contributing in. And I would say, kind of at a very high level, artificial intelligence is the decision aids provided to a human warfighter that helps tighten the kill chain, reduce the OODA loop, reduce time to decision, all of those sorts of things, right? And of course, that is behind the scenes, there's a lot of stuff that goes into that. But in general, it's leveraging specifically software-defined systems to get to a decision with higher confidence in a more timely manner than kind of traditional only human-based systems. And we can maybe dive into one of these rabbit holes if you want, but to me, that's what artificial intelligence comes down to, is how do you leverage software-defined systems in a way that adds an extra efficiency, confidence, or time-based boost to the decision process?
Yeah, no, that's good. I'm actually happy to run down one of those rabbit holes here, if you don't mind. My next question, really, and it's a very general question as well, but it's tied to what you just said. So why is AI important? Because I think what you see, or what you will see, or what, you know, a lot of folks have seen, is that a lot of times military commanders often feel like they are the best ones to make decisions. These folks are generally also, you know, a bit older, so they're less inclined to be technologically savvy and technologically, you know, intelligent. And so they may view something like AI that's cutting into their decision-making, because ultimately, you know, decision-making, everybody makes recommendations to the commander, but the commander is the one who makes the decision. So, yeah, just dive down a bit more on how that actually increases the confidence, because I like that phrase you said, a higher confidence in decisions.
There's a huge corpus of debate behind this entire topic, right? Like, what does it actually mean to have confidence? Who is actually making the decision, even if there's a decision authority that rests in a specific individual? Those decisions being informed by many things, including AI and other individuals, perhaps. Is it a rubber stamped decision? You know, like, what does it actually mean to, like, have the authority to make decisions? And so there's a whole bunch of debate that we could have there. But I would say this, right? And that is, the commander, especially in a warfighting scenario, or especially in a kill chain where there are pretty extreme consequences for making the wrong decision, and even making the right decision has implications that are severe, let's say, it is important that that authority still rests with the commander as they have executed decisions for quite some time. And I think replacing those decisions with a fully autonomous chain seems to be clearly a mistake. But when you examine those traditional decision processes, I think we have to take some humility when we say, well, perhaps that commander never actually had the confidence that he or she thought they had prior. And what I mean is, there are a lot of decisions that are being made without any evidence at all, without anything more than perhaps just a gut feeling, or maybe there are data supporting an effective decision. Maybe there is a justified reason for doing things, but those data or that information or that justification arrives to that authority too late, right? So the timeline within which they could process information is just very, very fast on the modern battlefield. And so leveraging AI helps to deliver the right data. It helps to deliver insights in a manner that actually affords the commander confidence in a time frame that makes sense. And a lot of this just goes back to examining with candor the processes of the past and realizing that though you have a human in the loop that you can say, well, this person was responsible, perhaps in the past, they never really had confidence beyond a gut reaction, right? And so for those sorts of decision processes, I think that's where AI is incredibly effective, because AI, almost by definition, software-defined systems, can process tremendous amounts of data globally much faster than any human could.
One of the phrases that you used there that I thought was really well was you spoke about candor, and I think that's where AI can also help. As I think about AI and its application in this entire decision-making process, is that it can help eliminate organizational bias in many cases, because it doesn't, you know, accidentally or purposefully inject, you know, whatever bias the organization may have, right? So if a commander likes a certain thing a certain way, but that leads to bad decisions, but the organization doesn't realize that, theoretically, that's something that I think AI can help solve, you know, just along the process of providing data that's not been tainted by that. And, you know, like you said, that getting the information in there quickly. So I guess with that, let's transition here to talk about CJADC2. So I think this phrase, it's thrown around quite a bit, and I think over the past couple of years, it's had a letter and a couple numbers added to it, because it started off as a far smaller acronym. And so what is CJADC2, and why should, you know, your average, you know, like the listener to this podcast, why should they care what it is?
Yeah, and actually just going back to the bias question just real quick, because anyone who is kind of astute on AI, I think gladly, you know, would raise their hand, because whenever you mention bias, especially if you're trying to say, oh, AI comes and eliminates human bias, that's true. Humans in a decision process have specific biases, but AI also has its own unique biases too. So you're not eliminating biases. You're just trading off maybe a human bias with an artificial bias. So that's a whole
something too with the code writers and the people that write all the algorithms. The bias at that end also trickles down through, correct?
That's correct. And I think the best thing that we do, again, cueing in on that word candor, it's not important to eliminate bias, right? Like it is actually fine for bias to be present in the systems. And in many ways, we rely on bias. If it's a human decision maker, I rely on someone who has years and years and years of experience to bring that experience to the fore, because that experience colors their decisions. And that's important. But what's important is to understand and kind of capture that the bias is present so that when you're making a decision, you kind of can... you understand what sorts of biases are present. And so if you're developing an AI system, it's important for you to present not just a recommendation, let's say, or not just that decision aid, but also package it with the assumed biases that went along with it. And then that helps inform the commander when they're making trade-off decisions. So anyway, there's a huge rabbit hole there. And again, when you talk about academic discussions, I mean, this is one of the top academic discussions when it comes to ethics of AI, especially in the military. So I couldn't let this conversation go without tapping on that just a bit.
No, that's terrific, because I think that's an important aspect of all this to understand too, is that it's helpful when you point out the bias too within an organization and the bias within those, you know, the system that's coming, because a lot of times people don't see themselves, organizations don't see themselves very well. And so the ability to count for, I think, I forget what you said specifically, but I liked it, where you just package that bias and let it be known that it's there, but you don't necessarily remove it from the equation. You just say, hey, by the way, it's factoring this bias in. But all right, thank you for that. So CJADC2. It's chained like 15 times since I've first started hearing about it. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, it started as, well, I don't know what it started as, but at some point it morphed into JADC2, or Joint All Domain Command and Control. They appended a C, which I've actually seen different interpretations of even what the C means. But in general, right, like the idea is, gone are the days where you have a kill chain fully prosecuted in a single domain by a single service. There are kill chains and there are mission workflows which almost ubiquitously require multi-domain support. And when we say domain here, we're talking things that are happening terrestrially, things that are happening in the air, things that are happening in the space, and also other dimensions, things that are happening in the cyber domain. And there are many, many different domains, but the idea is there's a mission which relies on all of those. And then the joint aspect is, it's not just an army unit prosecuting a specific mission thread. It's an army unit in collaboration with an air component, with a sea component, with a space component. And so this idea of how do we compose kill chains or kill webs, how do we compose mission threads where all of these different domains come together and all of these different formerly disparate service elements work together. And of course, the challenge from a weapon systems perspective, or from a engineered systems perspective, is that traditionally these missions were supported by systems that were developed completely isolated from the others, right? So the space component or the space system, separate from a land system, separate from an air system. And even within some of these systems, like a space system is separate from another space system, which is separate from another space system. So composing these kill webs, or composing these kill chains, or stitching together course of action decisions that relies on information from all of these, is a truly challenging problem, because fundamentally these different systems just, they don't talk to each other. I can't pull data from one domain and plop it in context with another domain. And that's kind of the core problem that JADC2 efforts within the different service elements are trying to solve. How do we break down these silos, whether it's a domain silo or a services silo or specific mission thread silo. How do we break down those silos so that the different domains, the different services, the different missions can share information and collaborate and create much more interesting solutions to warfighting problems?
Yeah, so as you were talking about that, a couple of ideas popped up in my head. And so just a few follow-up questions. So I'm going to list the three real quick just so you hear them and so I can remember them. I wrote them down, but I'm going to throw them out there, and then I'm going to actually flesh out the actual question. So the first one is challenges, second's vulnerabilities, and third's prioritization. So with that, I know you mentioned some of the challenges, and I guess I'm going to wrap this into the vulnerabilities question. This seems like something that potentially, given the fact that it's a network-centric approach or a network, it depends on a network, it seems like it would be highly sensitive to enemy actor tapping into that sensor and putting in bad data or bad information, or they could tap into the sensor or the network, whatever the case may be, and put bad data on that network. Is that something that's popped up as a significant challenge on your end?
Let me talk about thermostats, like home residential thermostats, right? Because I think this will put maybe some perspective to this, which is kind of interesting. And that is, there's a tendency to think here that, like, oh, the more compelling a system gets, the more prone it is to attack from the cyber domain. Like, ooh, I've got this really juicy JADC2 software system over here. That's definitely going to be a target of some state-sponsored cyber attack. Sure, but also my home thermostat that's sitting in my house right next, you know, over here one room over, is also a threatened asset on the global internet. Why? Because.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Any IP address out there can be assumed to be a target from cyber bad actors, just period. This is how the cyber domain works. If you broadcast yourself or you expose yourself to the internet or to a global network, you are potentially on an attack surface. And so I think regardless of how large and complex and cohesive these JADC2 systems are, or how large and cohesive these JADC2 systems are not. So that means either it's a giant cloud-based infrastructure or it's a very localized individual kind of dropped-in small network. Both of them are targets. And so I think it's probably a mistake to think of, oh, just because this system is huge and massive and crosses across different domain and mission boundaries, that it's more of a target. In ways, perhaps it seems like a bigger, juicier target, but a small system, especially if it's a system that's focused on prosecuting kill train, if it employs modern software technology, will also be a target too. So we shouldn't get in this trap of thinking that, oh, I'm small, I'm just a thermostat in someone's home, I'm not going to be a target for a cyber attack. I think that's a dangerous thinking. But I will say this, when you consolidate things into complex systems, when you pull everything together, there's a leveraged risk there. When that system gets attacked and more things are plugged into it and depend on it, then the consequences of a successful attack are greater, right? If my thermostat goes down in my home, well, there's this one house here that's going to be warm or cold for a few days. Big deal, right? But if an entire JADC2 system goes down, obviously that's a bigger impact. So that's, I would probably characterize the scope or the casualty impact of a consolidated attack on a central system potentially being where where that may be interesting.
Yeah, no, that's helpful and very useful. I like the thermostat analogy. I assume you live in Texas, right?
Yes, I live in Texas. We rely on our thermostats.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So I too live in Central Texas, and the thermostat thing, you don't even need a cyber attack to take it down with the Texas power grid being what it is, you know. We made it through this winter without losing power, which was nice, but I guess it's not quite over yet. So the other question then on the CJADC2 is prioritization. And so when I hear you talk about CJADC2, I think about project convergence. I assume this is one of the systems or one of the things in which this operates. And I know within that project convergence idea, it's any sensor, any shooter, whatever the rest of that little phrase is, potentially, and I'm sure this is part of what's being worked out or what has been worked out, but how does prioritization work if the idea is to reduce the amount of time that something's going through that OODA loop and getting that tight coupling between target identification and, you know, rounds impacting on the target? How do you balance doing that quickly at one place across a very broad front? Or is that something that is still being worked on?
This is a problem that I think is going to be worked on in perpetuity, right? When you look at software systems kind of writ large, nothing is ever done, right? When you deliver a product, a la you deliver some software system that accomplishes a task, especially in a warfighting domain, as soon as that goes out into quote unquote production, or as soon as it sees the light of day, the definition of that task changes. Maybe there's a cyber vulnerability, as we just discussed, that needs to be remediated. Maybe the enemy changes tactics. Maybe you deploy a new sensor. Whatever it is, the environment for which that software was originally authored changes almost immediately, post the day that it's pushed out to the environment. So when it comes to software-defined systems, you have to always be amending the software, making improvements, fixing gaps, et cetera. So I think there would be a danger to think about deploying or acquiring a JADC2 system, whether it be through project convergence or you name your JADC2 flavor, to think that that's an acquisition exercise that's going to be wrapped up in a box, tied a bow on top of, and in 3 years it's going to be done is just... That's a disaster kind of by prescription. So this is a project that's going to go on kind of in perpetuity. The other thing I would say when it comes to priorities, in many ways, the priorities are kind of tough to swallow because the number one priority is integration. Getting all of the systems together, when you talk about sensor to shooter, there's a lot of nuts and bolts and warring wheels and mechanics that have to actually be connected before you can show a sensor to shooter kill chain. So step one is having to integrate all of those things, laying the groundworks for data being in one place, laying the groundworks for software developers on one part of the system to quickly ingest and react to problems from another side of the system. Those sorts of things don't look like traditional acquisition because software development in many ways is not like traditional software acquisition, but laying the foundation for a software ecosystem to thrive is kind of the number one priority. Getting the software developers, getting the infrastructure, getting the integrated bits into a room so that you can respond to those emerging changes in the environment is more important than delivering any one capability. But that being said, of course, we have specific capabilities that we do have to deploy. And I'm not an expert. You know, when we talk about project convergence or the Army's requirements for JADC2, there are certainly priorities in the kill chain that must be delivered before other ones. And so that's the chief problem of someone who's perhaps running a C2 or a JADC2 program within project convergence. But when I put on my software engineering lens, to me, the number one priorities have got to be, you have to set the conditions. You have to set the integration, the consolidation, the software development. I kind of call it the second and third derivatives. How are you actually going to build software to respond to these threats? You got to get that base plate down first, and then you can go start attacking your individual mission priorities. I don't know if that makes sense. A lot of this is jargon as I'm jumbling it out, but it's different than building hardware, you know?
Yeah, no, that's good. The another thing that I was thinking about, I guess it's a branch off prioritization, is as we're thinking about these systems and how they're actually contextualized in the real world. And if you have any examples from the other services, maybe the Air Force, the Navy, feel free to throw those in. But as I think about it, I can see the logic that it would cause command posts and headquarters to shrink potentially because you don't need as many people doing as many things. But again, I'm not a computer guy at all when it comes to this kind of thing. Would it actually cause the number of people and things to go down, or would it cause, do you think maybe it's almost a relative just shift in what the people do? How do you see that impacting command posts and headquarters in a tactical on the battlefield sense?
This is kind of like the classic industrial revolution is going to kill our jobs kind of argument, right? And whether you're asking this question from a software perspective, how is software going to replace XYZ employee, or you're asking it from an AI perspective, how are automating some of these decision processes going to take humans out of the decision loop and replace them with robots? To me, it's a lot of the same of that industrial revolution. We're automizing a process. We're making something more efficient, and therefore, people are going to lose their jobs, or there are going to be less people involved in the thing that that was, you know, the process that we had in place before. And of course, over time, you see that that argument is just it doesn't end up coming true ever, right? The people end up doing fundamentally different things. That's 100% true. When the Industrial Revolution came across, the way that we made widgets, the way that we made cars, the way that we produce energy, all of those sorts of things changed in fundamental ways, and we no longer needed people to do the things they were doing prior. Absolutely. But those people went on to do more complex things in the system, and they made more complex widgets, and they made more complex cars, and the world is, of course, way better off for it. So when you look at JADC2, again, whether we're talking about adding some software to the decision loop or adding artificial intelligence models that make that decision process faster, it is absolutely going to change how humans interact with that environment. It's going to change the decision process of commanders. It's going to change how operators put down their coffee and conduct their 9-to-5 or whatever. But it's not going to replace the need for people to add human expertise to increasingly complex systems. And also, as that system becomes more complex, it's going to require people on the back end to sustain those systems. And again, if you look at industrial robotics, there's an entire industry now that never existed prior to, 20 or 30 years ago, and that is the sustainment of these incredibly complex, artificially enabled industrial systems. So there are people who are getting degrees in, there are people who are getting certifications in managing these giant robots that help in providing the mechanized automation of industrial processes. And those jobs never existed prior. So will it change some of the jobs from the past? Absolutely. And it will create new ones. And it will require humans to engage in more complex ways with systems that are becoming inherently more complex.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I hadn't, and I kind of was alluding to it a bit in the question, but you fleshed it out in, a very tangible way. People will do different things, and they'll be doing more complex work in the system, and it'll likely create whole new career fields for humans that didn't exist in the past or that don't exist today. If you will. So I guess as we're getting to the end of our time here, Q. So is there anything else that we haven't talked about yet that you'd like to mention before we break today?
Yeah, just to talk a little bit about what we're doing on the Air Force side, because I think a lot of conversations get lost in capabilities, right? Which is, what are you guys delivering to your customer? What sorts of requirements are you are you box checking such that a customer XYZ gets closer to some JADC2 reality? And those things are important. It's important that we are delivering a capability today that didn't exist yesterday. But what's more important to us and what's more important to the US government, if they can embrace this on a larger scale, is that, and I mentioned it before, kind of like that first or second derivative of how we're delivering it, right? We are not software engineers sitting in a room looking at a list of requirements, coding up solutions, putting a red bow on it, shipping it, and saying, there, you now have this capability, right? This, the entire process of sitting down and understanding how have things changed since we originally assessed this problem is fundamentally a new thing, right? Now, in the private sector, you talk about agile software delivery, true agile software delivery, not this kind of make-believe agile that we see in a lot of places, but true agile software delivery, which is we thought we knew what we thought we knew a year ago, but things have totally changed. And therefore, what I'm delivering today is something that didn't exist or didn't exist as a thought for a requirement back when we were put on contract. That is so very important. Like true nimbleness to environmental and threat changes, if you're not baking that into your software acquisition, you're just setting yourself up for a failure. And I commend the Air Force because I think that's one of the things that they've truly done very well, specifically in their cloud-based command and control effort, which is the Air Force, one of the Air Force's responses to JADC2, is that not getting distracted by a scripted requirements generated in the past, but embracing agile software delivery so that as environmental conditions change, software engineers and everyone supporting this program can respond in like kind. So it's a nuance of software development that doesn't necessarily exist in traditional acquisitions, but it's such a big part of it.
It seems like you would have to, and I'm sure this probably happened, but break down a lot of institutional processes and barriers to deliver that type of software with the bow on it, but that software package that's always being updated.
It's almost like you're not acquiring software, right? You're acquiring the capacity for software development, right? Like as a government purchaser or a government buyer, I want to have a result. I want to have a capability. But if you require for that capability, you're going to get it. And the needs for the capability are going to change, and you're going to wish that you had a way to change those things. So it's about acquiring the capacity for software development. It's about acquiring teams that can deliver changes, not so much acquiring a capability as prescribed by requirements documentation. But yes, it requires the right institutional mindset. It requires a contracting officer in an organization who understands software delivery in the true modern sense of the word. And it's not easy. Not easy.
Yeah, I'm sure that's been quite challenging to force that through. So, Q, thank you very much for your time today. I know you're a busy guy, so I'm going to go ahead and let you get going. So just thank you very much for your time, and I appreciate your conversation today.
I appreciate you, Amos. Thanks for having me on.
All right.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.